Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman.
Welcome to episode number 14, what we're calling Early Victory. Today, we're looking at the capture of Fort Ticonderoga on May 10th, 1775. This was initial early victory for the colonists and had a significant impact, but then turned into a long struggle, a defeat, and finally a victory. Before we begin, however, let's answer the question of where is Fort Ticonderoga? For all of those that haven't made it past Cleellum in your travels, let's look at a map of New York, find Lake Champlain up north, and Lake George. In between, you'll see the Lachute River, and there lies Fort Ticonderoga. And that fort played several key roles in the American Revolution. It had a strategic location, being situated at the southern tip of Lake Champlain in upstate New York. It controlled the main corridor between Canada and the American colonies. It's essentially a gateway between North and South. Whoever held it could threaten or defend either direction. It was captured by the Green Mountain Boys in May 1775. Just weeks after Lexington and Concord, Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys, along with Benedict Arnold, that guy, seized the fort from the British in a surprise raid. It was one of the first American offensive actions of the war, and a major morale boost for the Patriots. Then the Cannons of Boston followed, perhaps its most consequential contribution. The fort held a large supply of artillery. Henry Knox led a remarkable expedition in the summer, or rather in the winter of 1775-76, to haul roughly 60 cannons across frozen lakes and mountains to Boston. Washington positioned them on Dorchester Heights, forcing the British to evacuate Boston in 1776 without a fight.
Yeah, and this is one of those great stories of the American Revolution. You know, Knox was a bookseller in Boston, and yet turns into this important sort of military figure by leading this expedition, basically, to haul these 60 cannons, some of them weighing up to like 20 tons, across frozen lakes, you know, rowing down rivers, dragging sort of sleds through the snow to get them to Boston. And I mean, it's just this remarkable story of perseverance and sort of what you can do, you know, with basically human power. It reminds me of what the Vietnamese did at Dien Bien Phu, where they carried cannons up to the top of the surrounding hills at Dien Bien Phu, and the French, with their European arrogance, thought, oh, nobody can ever get cannons up to the top of those hills. And the Vietnamese did it, and the French were forced to basically surrender and retreat. And it sort of began the beginnings of the Vietnam War as the United States, you know, 10 years later. Dien Bien Phu was 1954. 10 years later, America has to intervene, and we begin the Vietnam War, the American phase of the Vietnam War. So never underestimate what patriots can do in a tight cause.
They should have listened to us had we existed then. But the other part of the Cannons of Boston is, and we'll be talking about it here in the next couple of weeks, is the whole Battle of Boston and Bunker Hill, Breed's Hill. And that, too, was a turning point. But we'll talk more about that here in about 2 weeks. What followed then? The 1777 campaigns. The fort changed hands again when British General Burgoyne easily captured it in July 1777.
And that's another interesting story. I mean, the fort, and John, you know this, the fort, it's a great design. It's a star-shaped fort, you know, made out of stone. It's beautiful to visit. But it sits at a low point, and so there's hills around it, which is that if you're in a fort, you want to be at the top of the hill, not at the bottom of the hill. And so it was relatively easy for the British to put cannons up on top of the hills, and the Americans sitting down there in the fort, recognized, man, they were done for, and so they surrendered.
And later on, many years later, the architect who designed it was called into question because it really kind of wasn't particularly well built, and it affected his career when he was knocked for his lousy design and engineering talent. Anyway, Burgoyne, in his subsequent push southward, ended in disaster at the Battle of Saratoga, a turning point that brought France into the war on the American side. So while losing Ticonderoga stung, it contributed to luring Burgoyne into an overextended campaign he couldn't sustain. So in short, the fort mattered both materially, the cannons, and strategically as a choke point on the invasion route from Canada. After these events, the fort's usefulness came into question, causing it to be abandoned by the British initially in 1777 and for good in 1781. A couple of interesting factoids about the facility. Over the last 2.5 centuries, 5 U.S. naval vessels have been named Ticonderoga, all served well, and the last was decommissioned and scrapped in 2004. The famous yellow Ticonderoga No. 2 pencil that we all grew up with and is still manufactured by Dixon Ticonderoga Corporation is named for the fort. The fort is a privately owned tourist stop today, and the lakes are popular recreation area, with Lake George known especially for an abundance of classic varnished speedboats and beautiful boathouses. So well worth visiting if you're up in those parts. So, Bruce, there are numerous events over the last 250 years of American history that echo these events. What are some of the most significant of these early victories by Americans that devolved into protracted, less successful conflicts?
Well, I mean, it starts very early for the Americans. You know, once we become an independent country, as we get into the War of 1812 with Great Britain, the U.S. decides to invade Canada, thinking this is going to be a very easy kind of thing. Canada's a relatively small British colony. The American independent United States had some initial naval victories on the lakes going up into Canada, but ran into Canadian resistance and British resistance, and ultimately led to the burning of Washington, D.C., famous Dolly Madison, sort of escaping with her china. So this idea of, wow, here's an easy plum to be picked, is deeply ingrained within American
just
military
history. They could have been a state.
Canada could have been a state. and that was the intent very early on, is to basically capture Canada, turn it into another United States state. But it went badly then, and it seems to be going equally badly right now. Another example, of course, is the American Civil War, where Confederate forces have very early victories at Fort Sumter, at Bull Run, and it looks like the Union is knocked back on its heels, and in many ways it was. But the Union had the resources and the industrial might that the South didn't have. And as the war drags on, and by the time of Gettysburg, sort of the high point of the Confederacy in the Civil War, once the armies are defeated at Gettysburg, it becomes a continual retreat into ultimate surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. So that sort of very early victories that the Confederates had during the war turned into this long slog of a battle that ultimately led to their defeat. And the same thing happens for the United States in the Spanish-American War. We have a very, very quick victories over Spain and Cuba and in the Philippines. And then in the Philippines, we decide to send in the U.S. Army into what's often called the Philippine-American War. And it just turns into this long kind of Vietnam-like struggle against Filipino sort of independent-minded forces. And even though America wins that war, it's at great cost, and it sort of establishes, an independence movement in the Philippines that ultimately comes flowering, 60 years later after World War II.
And still going.
And it's still going.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And then, of course, the Korean War, We'll talk next week about General MacArthur, who comes in as command of the American forces in Korea, and we roll back the invading North Koreans and Chinese. We roll them back to the Chinese border. And then the question is, do we invade China or not? And, of course, Truman and the political forces in D.C. said, no way are we going to invade China, and open that sort of box of worms, if you will. MacArthur, the commander-in-chief, wanted to go right into China, wanted to use nuclear weapons. And Truman said no, ultimately removed, MacArthur from command. But those very early victories, when the Chinese came in and rolled at Chosun Reservoir and other sort of early battles right at the Chinese border, you know, the Americans were pushed back to the Busan perimeter, down at the very southern tip of the Korean Peninsula, you know, and then MacArthur does this brilliant invasion along the sort of east coast of Korea, rolls back the Koreans and the Chinese to the 38th parallel, and that's when the war stalemates. So this very quick sort of roll back to the Chinese border and then roll back to the Busan perimeter and then invade and establish things where they are today at the 38th parallel. Another good example of this sort of American, sort of very quick victories followed by long struggles and
that never end.
Yeah, that is still going on. And of course, the Vietnam War is another great example of that. You know, 64, 65, you know, America sends in troops. We start bombing North Vietnam back to the Stone Age, in the quote of one of the military commanders, and that doesn't work. I mean, the insurgent forces in Vietnam were just so deeply embedded. You know, it was a revolution. In effect, in Vietnam, a civil war, and we ended up sort of backing the wrong side, and it turns into this long extended struggle. But initially, Americans went in, we're going to clean this up, we're going to get things stabilized, and we're going to walk away. Does not happen. And then, of course, the Middle Eastern wars, particularly the Iraq War, Desert Storm is just this magnificent display of American military might, you know, and we roll into Baghdad, you know, we overthrow the government, we capture Hussein, and it looks like, man, it's over. It ain't over. And It sort of goes into this long, extended struggle.
It sort of raises a whole question of, does anybody on our end have good planning or good future thoughts about what do we do? What's the exit strategy? And, you know, in the case of Vietnam, we left, and then a number of years passed, and I think it was Bill Clinton that finally opened the doors. And the other day I bought something from Amazon that said it was made in Vietnam. Well, now we have a trading partnership and things are okay. But it took a long, long time to get there. And that certainly wasn't planned.
No. Yeah. And that's, I mean, like any war, and we'll talk about it in a bit, but where we are right now in 2026, you see sort of military actions going on, and it's not that the military hasn't thought it through, but the political leaders often don't think
haven't it thought it through. Yeah.
And that's where you run into problem, because the military is designed for victories, and the American military is an exceptionally well-refined and powerful military. But that's only part of the struggle.
So let's look at current events. As they say, we live in interesting times right now. So what are some of the most significant events in the U.S. during the past 5 or 6 years that echo this Ticonderoga idea of early relatively easy victory and then a prolonged struggle? We've talked about some of them over the last 60 years, but what are some of them from the last few years?
Well, here we are in sort of the middle of 2026, and we're right in the middle of one of them. Back in June of 2025, we had these military strikes against the nuclear facilities in Iran, with the idea that we're going to knock out Iran's ability to create a nuclear weapon. Well, that doesn't, I mean,
it didn't play out quite right.
Yeah. I mean, we destroy facilities, but we do not destroy the abilities, and we do not destroy the reserves of nuclear material. And so what did we accomplish? You know, and here we are, we get into this sort of April, May of 2026, with the beginning of the Iraq, the Iran war. And again, you have these weeks of bombings and weeks of military might at work, and yet, you know, the outcome is highly uncertain. And it's created this sort of situation, very much like Vietnam in my mind, in which, you know, the United States has established military superiority, but we have not put down the ability of the indigenous population, to respond to that. And just like in Vietnam, where low tech often beats high tech, we had the helicopters, we had the B-52s, we had the jets, we had everything.
They had tunnels.
They had tunnels, they had bungee sticks, they had, and they had the population, and we saw that same thing in the Iraq war and in the Afghan war. There's no doubt that the United States had the technologically military superiority, but how do you fight an insurgency that's based in patriotism and based in blood and based in country? Because, these battles are taking place in people's, home territories. And it's a very, very difficult thing to have technology dominate those kind of, personal feelings and personal involvement that you get with insurgencies. And right now, here we are in the beginning of April, in 2026, and we're seeing a debate go on of whether or not we should put boots on the ground in Iran. We've been down this road. We've put boots on the ground in the Philippines. We put boots on the ground in Korea. We put boots on the ground in Iraq. We put boots on the ground in Afghanistan. And where are we?
Where are we? I guess we're where we have been with all these other events. And we're going to go in with no end game. And that's frustrating. And I think you can see that with the neighboring countries of Iran, who are very reluctant to get involved in this skirmish, even though they're getting shot at. I think they kind of know where this is going to end up and don't want any part of it. It's hard to blame them. So let's move ahead here and look at tariffs in the Supreme Court.
Well, the tariff thing, we're right in the middle of it. It's trying to analyze where we're going to be, but it's that same sort of concept that I think President Trump wanted to change sort of the American trade relationships. I think in his view, the United States has always been at a disadvantage with tariffs, and he wanted to change that. Of course, he has a late 19th century view of tariffs as mainly a way to create revenue, whereas in most of the 20th and the early 21st century, the view of tariffs have been a way to sort of create a globalized economy in which you get efficiencies because, China and Korea can make steel much cheaper than the United States can make steel. And of course, the dilemma with that is what if relationships with those countries turn sour? Where do we get our steel? And so that it's this problematic kind of relationship of what tariffs can and cannot do.
Well, and as part of that, South Korea is now building naval ships for us.
Oh, yes.
Right. Which, yep. I find that almost incomprehensible. No. But they can crank them out, and they do a great job.
Yeah, they can crank out. The last thing I saw about it, it takes us about a year to create a modern naval war vessel. Korea shipyards crank out, six or seven a year or something like that.
Something
it's just
like
sort
that.
Of like, wow, it's a— And again, it's not that we can't do it. It's just, is it the best use of our resources to have us do it or to have somebody else do it? And that's at the core of this sort of tariff debate. Do we want to go back to the concept of a fortress America, where America does everything for itself? Or are we really part of a global economy? And there are issues with globalization, of course. But at the same time, there's great efficiencies. All you have to do is walk into the toy department of any big sort of department store or Walmart or anything like that. Toys R Us. And if you walked into the toy departments of stores in the 1940s or 1950s, they were tiny, and toys were expensive, and there wasn't a choice. Now, I look at my grandkids and I walk into their sort of toy room.
It's all made in China.
Well, but it's not made here. Most of it's not made here. Oh. But there's just so much of it. Whatever they're interested in, there's a toy for them to pick up and play with to follow that interest. Whereas when, 50, 60 years ago, toys were relatively rare things. And it's part of that globalization that has created that kind of situation.
Well, to pick one product that I'm familiar with, Lionel trains, I collect them. Mm-hmm. And, if you look back to when Joshua Lionel first started it, everything was made in New York and later in Michigan. Company went bankrupt a few times. They also made defense things during World War II. But today it's owned by a holding company out of North Carolina, and everything's made in China or Indonesia. And some of it's really, really interesting stuff, but the old stuff is just built like a tank. And the new stuff has lots of electronics, but it's not the same. Yeah. So anyway. So we talk about, we've hit tariffs, Supreme Court.
Well, we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on the tariff case, and that will, that's going to be a really interesting sort of decision. The initial ruling that they've made is that many of the tariffs that were imposed initially are illegal. And then the question becomes, okay, what replaces those tariffs? How do we pay back the fees, the tariff fees that have been paid? I mean, it is just going to be a nightmare for a long time to get that settled. And then what are the tariff policies that are going to generate out of that? What are the tariffs going to be moving forward? And that feeds into a larger sort of question of the relationship between the United States and Europe, the United States and Asia, and all these trading partners that we have around the world. Things right now are in chaos. The war in Iran has sort of put the foot on the accelerator of that chaos. So we see shipping costs going up because fuel costs are going up. And it's just the American public is going to see a major sort of inflation here over the next year and a half. And how are we going to deal with that? And what is it going to do to the American economy? It's too early to say, but it's going to be, as the old saying goes, buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a rough ride.
Well, and the year I keep hearing is 2035. I don't know if there's some magic to that, but or accuracy, I should say. But I get concerned with our legislative bodies, specifically Congress, that is not focused at all, seemingly, on debt, on excessive spending. And they just keep going, and even our local legislature is that way. And it can't go on and on and on. And I think there's some concern about what will happen to Social Security around 2035, which makes me really thrilled, having just gone on it. But it's our elected people. I don't think they ever took an economics class. It sure feels that way anyway. And they don't really want to focus on it.
Yeah. But it's that, again, it all traces back. And I don't think this is particularly unique to the United States, but in the United States, it's been a big part of it, is that sense of, these easy sort of early victories, if you will, easy implementations. You know, when once they're in place, they turn into long, drawn-out struggles with incredible unintended consequences.
We like easy fixes.
We do.
But they really aren't. So let's jump to Vashon.
Mm-hmm.
What are some Vashon events that echo this Ticonderoga theme of an early first and then a long struggle?
Well, one thing that pops to my mind is Vashon schools. You know, Vashon schools have a long, interesting history, but, you know, at one point there's 13 school districts on Vashon. I mean, every little community had their own school district, you know. School district at Southern Heights, school district in Docton, school district at Covos, you know, school district at Vashon, school district at Burton, school district at Shadaka, school district at Vermontville. I mean, the list goes on and on.
And they must have been like one building school districts?
Well, most of them started as one room schoolhouses. Yeah. But you know, they grew. You know, very typical. There's a schoolhouse out on Maury Island right off of Point Robinson Road. There's another one on Wax Orchard Road that are now private homes. And they were these were mostly built in the 1910s and 1920s. They're very substantial, big two-room schoolhouses, sometimes four-room schoolhouses. You know, windows that ran from the ceiling to the floor. I mean, they're magnificent buildings. But what happens with the automobile and with the development of roads, you no longer need a school within walking distance. And so what you get, particularly beginning in the 1910s up until 1940, you get consolidations. You know, school districts start to combine. And in 1940, there's actually a island-wide vote to create a Vashon Island School District. So the school district we have today was created in 1940. The only school district that voted against it was the Columbia School District over in Cove. They wanted to keep their own school, but
I always liked it over there.
They were outvoted, so they kept the Columbia School stayed open for a few more years, but ultimately were combined into two grammar schools, one at Burton and one at Vashon. And then in the late 1920s, the island actually voted to create a single high school district. So you had all these school districts, but you had one high school. And that came out of two high schools, one at Burton and one at Vashon. And, of course, the football games between Vashon and Burton were monumental kind of struggles, if you will. The whole island would show up, and there'd be conflicts and all that kind of stuff. But that sort of long struggle in 1940 to create one school district and then gradually consolidating into Burton Elementary and Vashon Elementary, you know, building a new high school in the 1960s and then again a new high school in the early 2010s, you know, building McMurray Middle School in the late 1950s, And the school district in the 1940s actually had the foresight to buy the land around Vashon High School. So they were able to hold the land that now has Vashon High School, McMurray Middle School, and Chautauqua Elementary School, built in the early 90s, that combined Vashon and Burton Elementary Schools. And so now you have one central campus for the whole island. But, you know, you look at where that took. I mean, it took 50, 60 years to get there. So that's just one good example of that sort of Vashon, you know, early create a school district. Oh, we're going to solve all these problems. And it doesn't do it. It takes them 60 years to actually get to the point where they have a consolidated school district.
And that's one of our governing bodies on this island.
It is.
It is. So with that, as always, thank you for joining us. And we will see you next week.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250@voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vachon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.